This is Jack Spierko, another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, July 23rd, 2026, and this is episode 3,873 of the Survival Podcast. It is an expert panel Q&A show for the week, and I've got a great lineup for you this week. Leading off with Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams, as always on these shows, it seems, with the Liberty Report's highlight of the week. Their piece this week is titled, "We Wanted the Middle East Bases Closed, Trump Got Them Blown Up Instead." I think they're pretty spot on with this one, but I also think they're doing the thing that libertarians really need to stop doing, and that is exaggerating failure of things they don't like. If we're going to get anywhere with libertarianism, and I don't think we are, by the way, but if we are, then we have to grow up, we have to be pragmatic, and we have to be fact-based. And so I'm not saying they're not fact-based, but you can be fact-based and then exaggerate the adjectives, because our presence in the Middle East isn't going anywhere. Unfortunately, because that's my goal, too. I would close just about every U.S. military base around the world, bring everybody home, and then dare a MF or to think about messing with the homeland. That would be my preference. It's just that's not what's happening here. Iran is not proven to be anything close to a military match for the United States military. Patrick Rohrman will talk about how to sharpen a chainsaw chain. Jesse Markowitz will answer a question. When is the right time to buy Bitcoin? And I think his answer and mine may be phrased differently, but it's pretty much like all the time. But there's also something in this question that we get to I want to key in on, because I think the people that are in this area of it always fret the most about a question that doesn't really matter very much. Anyway, then Matt Sersley is going to do a great segment. I love myth busting. Especially about things that everybody thinks they know and influencers repeat, etc. He's going to bust 4 tax myths for you today. Then Ryan Steva is going – not Ryan Steva. Why did I put Ryan Steva there? Probably because I had Ryan in the lineup and I put him on the reserve list so I'd have some reserve content for next week. I'm sorry, Mike Melito is going to be talking about choosing the right AR-15 sling for your needs. And I have to tell you, this one gives me some flashbacks, not in a good way. Once we hear his, I will explain it. And then I'm going to finish up with a segment on AI. And it's not so much for how you should use AI, but it does apply to you as an individual, but less than the people I'm going to talk about. I'm going to tell you the real reason so many companies are not getting what they expect from AI. They're not getting a high return of investment. They're not getting high levels of production being increased. I've covered this in the past, but even the ones that say they are, and that's the reason they're laying people off, it's not why they're laying people off. They're laying people off because they got a whole shitload of very cheap money, and the cheap money's run out. And now they're right-sizing, and in many cases, they're not even right-sizing. You know, there's been many cases of companies laying off, let's say, 2,000, 5,000, 15,000 employees because AI took their jobs. And then, you know, a week or two later, hiring an equal or close to equal amount of people on H-1B visas. So they're using it for cover fire, which means they're not getting the results they want. That's the bigger issue here. Why? It's actually really easy to understand, and the bigger names in AI that talk about it and speak about AI all the time are starting to touch on this topic. It's starting to come from people like Jeff Woods and some others, but it's something I've been saying for a very, very long time. And I think it's because I've seen enough technology transition in my life that I've seen it happen before. It's basically you're putting an engine into a car that is not ready for the engine. And we'll talk more about that. I'll give you a pretty cool analogy that uses that right there when we get to my segment. Before we do that, let me remind you guys a couple things. One, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And our item of the day this week, so it's been an item of the week really, has been the Anker V20i headphones. I love those things. I have made them kind of my official Bluetooth earbud product, not only to recommend, but to use. I wait for them to go on sale, and if I'm down to one set because I've lost something, which happens, if I want a backup, I pick up another one whenever they go on sale. They're about $29 when they go on sale. They're on sale right now. They have fantastic sound. They have loops so they don't fall out of your head and land in the grass and disappear in the garden or in the stock tank or whatever else they choose to jump into. They are waterproof, so they're not going to get damaged if you end up out in the rain or sweating on them. They won't buzz your ears and electrocute you either. And they're cheap enough that if you are like me and you tend to get, what does Nicole Sauce say? She's like, you ADD disappeared it. Like, if you're that person and you just can't bring yourself to be spending $100, $150 or more on something that you know sooner or later you're going to leave somewhere, then these are for you. If you want a great value with great sound, then these are for you. If you, like me, have something weird with your ears, and specifically mine is my left ear, I swear to God, all the ones that just go in the ear, my left ear at some point just goes, I don't want that in here anymore, and spits it out, like projects it. If you feel it, and you're like, I'm going to catch it, and no, it's gone. Right? Like, if any of those things apply to you, then you want to get these. And Anchor is a great company overall. And if you use Anchor products from my past recommendations, specifically Anchor audio products, not just the battery backup stuff and all, then you need to know that they make a really great app that you can download. Just search for Anchor in your app store of choice. You'll find it, and you can have incredible additional control over your Anchor devices, and that's completely free, and it has nothing to do with whether you buy these today or not, just do you use Anchor audio product. Next up, if you have not picked up a copy of Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life, my new book that's out on Amazon right now, please consider doing so. When you search for my books, this is something you need to know about the Laws of Life series. If you stick in something like Laws of Life, Jack Spirico, most likely you will see the two results in the top of the listings for Book 1, Second Edition, and Book 2. Sometimes you won't. Sometimes you'll see my original first book, the first edition of Book 1, and I have made it really obvious, if you read the description at all, what you're looking at. This basically, I put in bold type at the top of the listing, do not buy this book, because Amazon will not suppress the search result. And I don't want anybody buying the wrong one. But, you know, pick up a copy of one or both. And the cool thing about Book 1, if you want the second edition, not only can you get the updated version, but you can get a hard copy. And I'm going to tell you, I was never in love with the print quality, the binding quality, anything about the soft covers that came out of the KDP program from Amazon for self-published authors like me. The hardcover books are as well put together as anything you'll find on a shelf in a bookstore. I'm not even sure exactly why they read easier to the eye, but they do, because it's the same font size and everything else, and it's the same footprint size of the book. It just, everything about them is better, and if you want them long-term on your bookshelf, that would be the way to go. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and dig into today's episode, leading off with Dr. Paul, and let's hear about, well, what's going on with our bases over in the Middle East around the Iranian conflict.
Debasification, a fancy word for booting the U.S. out of the Middle East. Now, I think the title, let me see. I called it the silver lining in Trump's Iran debacle, because this really is a silver lining, Dr. Paul. I mean, we non-interventionists are finally getting what we want. Unfortunately, I would have wished that we would have won the debate, that the Washington think tankers would have called you up and said, Dr. Paul, we realize that non-intervention is the way to go. You win the debate. I would have liked for it to happen that way, but unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. What happened is that our bases, our defense, our military was tested in the Middle East by Iran, and it came up wanting. It was not able to defend the other countries, and in fact, we've talked about it a few weeks ago, essentially all of our military bases in the Middle East are either destroyed or severely damaged, and we won't be moving back into them. So we won, but not the debate.
So you're not buying into my suggestion that maybe our policies are being run by a plant, somebody, a libertarian plant who's trying to trying to enforce and popularize our position. This is just to come home.
Yeah.
Well, they took their first step, a major step today. Is it an admission of a failure, which is more likely the case, that things aren't going so well?
Well, you know, the strength of deterrence is ambiguity. You don't know whether they can completely defeat you, but you feel like you shouldn't try because you may get defeated. Now, once you get rid of that ambiguity, then the cards are on the table, as Trump likes to talk about. Well, we put our cards on the table and they were deuces, right? We weren't able to defend. The deterrent in the Middle East has been defeated. And once the genie gets out of that bottle, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. We can't go back to those bases and say to Saudi Arabia, okay, well, we'll defend you this time, trust us. Or go to Qatar and say, trust us, let us back, we can defend you. We failed all these other times. We don't have any missiles left, but we'll defend you, trust us. Nobody's going to trust us. So, in fact, we are out of the Middle East. This is kind of a Berlin Wall that has fallen. And it is good news, I think, for the American people.
All right, I'm just going to say that what they said happened is happened, but I think their inference about what's going to happen next is wrong. I really do. I don't think they're going to have the U.S. pull out. I think that this damage that's been done to these bases will be rapidly repaired. I think U.S. military capability in the Middle East has been impaired in pockets. Like, at this base, this one ability has been impaired. The totality of our ability to operate and strike has not been pushed back 2%. And I think there's a lot of hope in the libertarian community, the left side of the community, like, across the board. Anybody doesn't want this. There's a lot of, like, this bizarre rooting against your own country, basically. And then that leads to an inaccurate assessment about force capability. Because if having like some radar and missile batteries damaged and some housing barracks damaged means that the U.S.'s ability to operate in the sector has been impeded to the point where it's half of what it was or whatever, then Iran wouldn't exist because we've returned this damage literally on a mathematical scale about 2,500 to 1. That is a mathematically accurate assessment of the situation. And so what happens next, I don't know. But I also will tell you that there is a big part of me that believes that the Democrats are making a concerted effort to stop this war, not because they care about your children dying, because they don't. And you know they don't. And not because they don't want money spent, because you know that's not true either. But because on the off chance, or the 50-50 chance, the coin flip chance, that before the election, this draws to a conclusion that the U.S. can put a feather in its cap and say, this is a victory. Even if a minute analysis doesn't feel like the average person takes it that way, then this election that's theirs to lose right now gets lost. If you add to it the communist uprising and the war within the Democratic Party itself, it would be a catastrophic failure. So I'm just going to tell you, no, we're not closing our bases because they got damaged. No, the countries that we have bases in are not going to throw us out because the bases got damaged. And no, our overall macro policy on the Middle East is not going to change anytime soon. It isn't. And I really don't think it makes sense to root against your own country, even if you don't agree with what they're doing or how they're doing it. Especially in this scenario, I just don't get it. Other than such a desire to be right that you end up in that position. That's my thoughts. Let's talk about something a little more homesteadish, a little more practical, a little more useful on the ground right where you are, like how to sharpen a chainsaw with Patrick Horman.
Hey guys, Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's expert counsel segment of the week. Today's question comes from Jesse. Jesse says, hey, primary question. What is the easiest method for sharpening chainsaw blades? Details. I live in a wooded property in East Tennessee and have a lot of smaller trees to clear on my land and use as firewood. I have a couple of different saws and blades get very expensive to purchase. I have a round file, but it takes forever. and if not done right, doesn't produce a great edge. Is there a tool I can use to save blades and to make them last longer? Thanks for the question, Jesse. So I feel your pain. I have three or four different chainsaws, and I have tried different things over the years, primarily hand sharpened chains. I did buy a chain sharpener. I bought an Oregon. This is my experience, right? So hand filing takes practice, and it is slow, fairly slow. Until you get really good, still even then, it's not the fastest in the world. If you get good at changing a chain on a saw, it is far faster just to slap a new chain on that saw and keep cutting. So for me personally, what I like to do is I like to have 5 to 10 chains for each saw, which is an upfront investment. And that allows me to, when I need to cut wood, to just throw a chain on, go cut wood. The minute it starts cutting, you know, swap out the chain and keep going. Or I will go ahead and take the hand file and give it a few passes and keep cutting. Sometimes just a few passes will bring that chain back to life. And other times, you know, you just like, I'm going to throw in a new chain, right? Now, like many things in life, you think, well, if I have this tool, it's going to be, you know, the secret to saving time, saving money, making my life easier. What I found with the Oregon sharpener is, depending on your different chain sizes and chains, there are different stones that you might have to change on the sharpener, which requires time, and different pitches and angles that you have to set. So all that being said, it's really best if you're going to use the machine to sharpen 5 or 10 chains that are all the same at the same time, because you have to change the sharpener settings each time you set up. So if I have 10 chains that all need sharpened, I can set, and they're all the same, I can set the machine up, go through and sharpen the right side, change the machine, sharpen the left side, change the machine, and touch up the rakers, right? So that being said, the big thing is when sharpening a chain is not only to sharpen the teeth, but to make sure your rakers are properly set. The rakers are what allow the chain to cut the proper depth of cut. And you could go and take your rakers completely out, but then the saw is going to be a lot more prone to kickback, and it's really going to get aggressive when it cuts. There's a lot to sharpening chainsaw blades. And then that kind of begs the question of, when is it worth just paying somebody else to do, right? So depending on your situation, if you don't do a lot of cutting, you can't justify the expense of having a sharpener and, you know, all the things. Sometimes it's just worth it to pay somebody else to do the job. Now, the downside to that is, if you don't have the tools, you are stuck only being able to get that service done. You're at the mercy of whatever business it is or whoever it is that's going to sharpen your chains. Maybe they can't get to them right away. Even if they can, you have to drive who knows how far to drop those chains off and then either wait for them to be sharpened or pick them up, you know, the next day. So, beings this is the Survival Podcast and we talk about preparedness and things of those sorts, I think it's very valuable to have those tools at your disposal, to have the, you know, have the extra chains, have the files, have the mechanical sharpener. It gives you another layer of resilience. It gives you another layer of, you know, just protection, being able to be prepared for when times get tough or even when they don't. And on top of that, maybe you enjoy sharpening chains and maybe it's another way to bring in a couple bucks, or just, by favor with your neighbors, to be able to sharpen their chains for them as well. It'll be interesting. I've set my sharpener up and I've used it a few times, but as I get my shop in order, I want a dedicated place for it to stay and to be used and to train maybe even my sons on how to use it. And it could be a good, another source of income. All that, I hope this helps you. Chainsaw sharpening is a very valuable tool to have. And that's the other thing I'd say too. Most people wait too long to sharpen their chain. You should touch up your chain every tank or two of gas. That seems crazy, but it is so much easier to maintain a chain than it is to restore a chain. I hope that helps. This has been Patrick with MT Knives. Stay sharp.
So I do recommend the Oregon saws that have the integrated sharpener, but I don't even know if they make the cordless one that I have anymore. And if that's true, and I haven't checked into it, but I've heard something recently that made me feel like that was the case. It may be that I'll get stranded with, you know, when my battery packs no longer work, I'll be stranded with a saw that's useless. They do make for the backyard person, though, they do make I think it's a 16-inch bar plug-in saw. And it's really great. This is not what Patrick's talking about. It has an integrated sharpening system, but that means you have to use their specialized chains. And those chains will cost about twice as much as a chain that is just a normal chain. And chains eventually, no matter, you know, they wear out even with sharpening. Like, you get to a point where, like, okay, it's been sharpened as much as it's going to be sharpened, and it's done. And I would say they probably wear out about 10 to 15% faster with the integrated sharpening tool. Oregon does make, or did make, a thing that would basically, you buy their chain at the size bar of the saw you have, and then you kind of put this thing on the end of it, and you push the point of the saw like into like a tree, something hard, and then you revved it a couple times. And I don't know if it works. I've never tried one. I will tell you, DeWalt's new cordless little bitty chainsaw has a hell of a lot more power than the Oregon one with the integrated sharpening. So that doesn't really have anything with sharpening, just if you care about electric saws and light use. But I think Patrick's approach, buy more chains than you need and just swap the chain. It's way faster. I've also worked with some guys that cut for a living. Like, they do it every day, nonstop type guys. I'm going to tell you, they go further. The average homesteader is not going to do this. But I'm going to tell you, like, I've talked to somebody, they have 4 or 6 saws. And literally, when that saw stops cutting, they just shut it off and grab another one and keep going. And then, you know, they set aside a day a week or something to sharpen chains. And, you know, like, the end of a shift or whatever, or a lighter day, you know, then they'll swap the sharp chains out with all, like, that's literally how they do things. And so what Patrick's doing is a scaled-down version of that that fits the average homesteader who, you know, might have a couple of 3 saws, but they're not going to be sitting there with, like, 6 all rigged up with 22-inch bars for, like, and heavy, expensive saws, like high-end Husqvarnas, high-end Steels, things like that. It's kind of the same but different man, right? And I think it's a really good approach. And for the person that's mostly like a homesteader, like, if you had 6 to 10 chains, you're going to go a long time with average use before you need to sharpen. And what that can literally let you do is just wait for a lull. And like he said, if you are using a, like, a kind of a setup, I call them more jigs than sharpening machines, most of them anyway, you have to adjust everything for what you're doing. And then going in kind of a production mode when you do that, like if you had 10 chains and when you got to 6 needing sharpening, you started looking for a time to do it. And then a tedious task can become like a just something to do when you're bored. So now you're bored, instead of binging some bullshit on TV or something, you know, throw the chain on the system and start sharpening it. And if you are a person that most of us are going to have 1 saw, maybe 2, maybe a little one and a larger one, then, you know, it's really quick. I might even, if you find a system you like, because they're not that expensive, these jigs, if you find one you really like and you have 2 different saws, you might set up 2 jigs and just leave them alone. Just some additional thoughts. Good stuff from Patrick as always. Next up, we're going to talk about buying Bitcoin with Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. I've received a number of questions recently as Bitcoin has dipped below $60,000 per coin, down dramatically from its high of over $125,000. A good example is a question from Emily. Emily asks, out of curiosity, and acknowledging this would be in no way advice, are you actively buying at the moment or just holding? I wouldn't have much to put in, but I am considering another teensy investment, just from what I'm observing. Is this a definitely buy now situation? Emily, first, thank you for framing the question that way, because that is exactly the right caution. Let me start by saying my answer is for educational purposes only, not financial advice. I don't know your personal financial situation, obligations, or risk tolerance. What I can do is tell you how I think about it. My personal answer is pretty boring. I'm a long-term Bitcoin holder, and I prefer buying according to a plan rather than trying to guess the perfect moment. My plan is simple. Dollar cost average, buying a set amount on a regular schedule. Trying to time Bitcoin is hard. When the price is falling, people get scared and they wait for it to fall more. When the price is rising, people feel like they missed out and can freeze and do nothing. Either way, emotion starts making the decision. My goal is to accumulate slowly over time with money I can afford to put away. This does not make Bitcoin safe nor guarantee a profit, but it does keep me from spending large amounts of effort trying to time every purchase perfectly. Buying Bitcoin should not make your situation more fragile. Bitcoin is volatile. It has gone through enormous drawdowns and run-ups before, and I expect it will again. It can be a part, an important part, of your overall financial plan, but you shouldn't be betting the farm on it. Your financial plan should still include having cash reserves, paying down bad debt, saving for near-term expenses, and planning for the future. You should understand what you're doing and why. Don't buy Bitcoin because someone online is excited or you're afraid of missing out. Don't buy because I'm buying or Jack is buying. I believe that Bitcoin is a better long-term savings technology than U.S. dollars. It provides a way to hold value outside the traditional banking system. It is useful because no company or government controls the network. Be clear on your beliefs, not mine. Finally, what makes Bitcoin really special is that you can hold it and control it easily. You can send or receive any amount easily, cheaply, quickly to your neighbor or around the world, and no one can stop you. So if you haven't started actually using your Bitcoin, do that. Buying a Bitcoin ETF can be fine. For some people, especially inside a retirement account, an ETF may be the easiest way to get price exposure. I'm not against that, but owning shares of a Bitcoin ETF or owning Bitcoin on an exchange is not the same thing as owning and using real Bitcoin. With an ETF, you have exposure to the price. You're not learning about self-custody, transactions, and how Bitcoin works. Bitcoin is not just an investment ticker. It is a working monetary network. If you believe it matters, you should learn how to use it. The first time you use self-custody should not be with a life-changing amount of money. Your first time driving a car is not in an F1 race. Learn when the stakes are low. Bitcoin can be a part of your preparedness. You do not want to be figuring out wallets, seed phrases, recovery, addresses, transaction fees, confirmations during a crisis. You want to learn now, calmly, with a small amount, while mistakes are cheap. So, in summary, I am actively buying Bitcoin now, just like I was last month, and just like I will next month. I'm not looking for the magical, perfect moment. I think in terms of long-time horizons, regular accumulation, and practice using the tool. Evaluate your situation, and if it's right for you, consider purchasing some Bitcoin and learn to use it. If you need help, there are many resources online, and of course, you can reach out to me as well. The people who only own Bitcoin as a line item in their financial accounts may benefit if the price goes up. But the people who understand how to hold it, secure it, and use it are the ones who actually gain the independence that Bitcoin was designed to provide. Build the skill, not just the balance. This has been Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Emily and everyone, thanks for the questions. Please keep them coming. I always enjoy answering questions about Bitcoin, self-custody, and practical independence. If you have a significant amount of Bitcoin and wonder if your storage, backups, and recovery plan are as solid as they should be, reach out to me about my Bitcoin risk assessment.
So the part of this that is almost inevitably always present when somebody asks this question, especially this way, is, I'm going to buy a very small amount. And my response to that is, and I know this is going to sound elitist or an asshole or something, it doesn't really matter when you buy it then. Because if you only go with a small amount one time and you're done, let's say you bought, I don't know what a small amount is, but I heard the word teeny in there. So $200 probably wouldn't be something you'd say, but let's say it's teeny. And so then let's say that Bitcoin eventually 5Xs. That's $1,000. Okay, good, right? And that'll probably take years for it to happen, honestly. Five times 300. Okay, probably next cycle, maybe, right? And that's great, but then what? Right? That's not life changing. It's not retirement money. It's not even change your retirement money. If you just want to take your money and go blow it, maybe it's a cheap cruise. 4 years from now, would that still be the case? I don't know. Right? It's not that much of an imperative. And it's also all, and I'm not picking on the person who asked the question. Please don't think that. But it's also, that's the same person who then checks the price and their balance like three times a day forever. And they have a 401k plan that dips 45%. They don't even blink. They just let their contributions keep going. And that's what Jesse was talking about, the system. So I am a big believer that systems over willpower in all things that matter. If you just, well, I'll get to it. I'll take care of it. It never works. Having something that's systematized with a rule and a standard that holds you to it will work better. So how about a teeny amount becomes $5 a day? How about a small amount becomes $10 a week? With services like River and Strike, you can set up an auto buy like that, and it's a lot less likely to cause you to forget about it and then be mad than something like a Netflix subscription that you no longer use. Because the way those services generally work, unless you completely integrate your banking or something with them, you make a deposit with a bank wire transfer and it goes into your account, and then you set up your daily buy. And all that happens when you, like, let's say you have a set up a $5 daily buy and you put $100 in there, and all of a sudden you get to $0, they don't like come after you. Your buy just doesn't go. And they send you a notice and say, hey, if you want your daily buy to keep going, put more money in. And you can set up that any way you want. It can be $25 a month. It can be $50 a month. It can be $1 a day. And so to me, the compounding effect of buying on the ups and the downs continuously across time, waking up every day following my rule of ending every day with more stats than you started with, and you did it before you got out of bed, my buy goes off at 3 a.m. Why? Because it feels good. I get up and I go to get the coffee and I start my 5 a.m. ritual or whatever, and I check all my stuff on my phone. It says daily buy. Happened. You know, you just got 15,000 sats or whatever. I'm pretty happy, you know. And even with, I hold a lot, I still is a bare, and I mean a bare minimum, $10 a day. That's $300 a month. That's way more than some people would be comfortable with. That's okay. But whatever you would be comfortable with a month, I would go to a daily or weekly buy. And this is a great time to do that because Bitcoin is going to probably go down. I do not think the floor is in. I think the floor hits October, November-ish. And I think it's more November and probably about mid-November. The floor has a tendency to hit exactly about within a week before or after a survival podcast workshop, which is always November, yeah, the week of November 11th, most of the time. That's what happens, right? So it's happened in all the cycles, right? And there's no reason to believe it won't this time. And all the indicators kind of flash that. And so a person would say, well, why don't I start buying them? Because you're buying all the way down and all the way up with a systemic daily buy. And so that's what I would really recommend that you do. I am comfortable recommending that at this point in history to everybody. I used to say, if it's money you wouldn't put on a blackjack table, we're back to 2017, then don't put it in Bitcoin. And at this point, we have a much more mature asset. It's ingrained into pension funds, etc. This is like any other long-term asset you would buy now from a purchasing viewpoint. The way you do it is consistency over time. That's just my thoughts, but if you just want to buy $300 and put it away and forget about it, that's okay. I'm not putting it down. I'm just answering your question with a suggestion rather than a definitive. Anyway, moving on. Let's hear about how to go from zero to one, not with Bitcoin, right? But zero to one with pull-ups. Yep, zero to one with pull-ups. How do you do that? Andy's going to give you some advice. I have a little extra advice on this one.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you live. Just kidding, I'm recorded here in Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. I am a 52-year-old man. I am an engineer out of Georgia Tech. I was an electrical engineer for a very long time. It was a great job. I loved it. I learned to solve problems. I took that problem solving into the health and fitness world. And this is what I do for you guys here. I am your health and fitness guy. I do, yes, I have other side hobbies. I mean, you can't be an entrepreneur without all these stupid little things you like to do. But today I had the question, Andy, how do I get my first strict pull-up? Guys, it is a ratio of how strong are you and how much do you weigh. That is the quite simple math of it. You have to be stronger than your weight, or you have to be stronger than the gravity on your weight. So if you go to the moon, probably could do a pull-up, but that's an expensive way to get there. I do have programs that I'm happy to give you on how to get a strict pull-up. It's not tough. Basically, what you're going to do is a mixture of negative. So you jump up, hold yourself, and let yourself down gently, and you extend that negative over time. Banded, so you use a band to help pull yourself up. And then if you have different styles or thicknesses of bands, it'll give you a different resistance. And you use that, decreasing the resistance over time. You do some dumbbell rows. So go Google that one or YouTube it. You'll see what a single arm bent over dumbbell row is. Basically, it's a pull-up just with one arm. You increase the weight of that dumbbell over time. But the bigger thing is you need to practice. After you work out, whatever it is you do, just do something in the system for 3 to 5 minutes. It doesn't take long, but you have to do something. And I'm happy to give you a program. Actually, I'll try to attach one for Jack, and he can include it if you want. Or maybe I'll do a better one where up to a link. That way you can just hyperlink it. And you can just follow that. It's not terribly complicated, but you have to put attention to it. The bigger one is you have to lose weight. If you're like, I can't really do it, well, it could be strength, it could be weight, why not attack them both? If you're looking for someone to help you lose weight, I probably am not the guy for you. I'm not a great one-on-one counselor because I've got too many jaded years of experience, but I have coaches at my gym that you can hire. I've got Coach Matt Bentowski. He is 6'8", and he is massive. He's a huge dude. He looks like one of the guys from the Reacher show, that Alan, whatever his name is. So if you're a big dude, hire him. If you are a female, I've got Coach Jen and Coach Jamie. Coach Jen focuses a lot on nutrition. Coach Jamie focuses on therapy. That's her normal job. So you'll get a little mixture of that. Then I also have Coach Josiah. He's got, this guy is awesome. If you are like, no, Andy, I need super white glove experience. I need you to be like in my gym all the time and helping. This guy is your man. Coach Josiah is rock solid. Anyway, you can hire those guys. I know, like, and trust them. And I want you to hire them directly. You don't even hire them through me. I would connect you and you just pay them. I want to lift their boat of entrepreneurialism. Go to them. So you need to focus on your strength and you need to focus on your weight. The easiest things are stop eating after like 8 p.m. That'll help a lot. The next one would be don't eat like a death row inmate. there are other things you could do, like increase your protein intake. Now, I would consider protein things that had a face. Yogurt with more protein in it, I personally don't consider. And I know you're going to be like, Andy, but it counts. Look, that's fine. That's what you believe. I don't like it. I don't think it counts. I know most people don't agree with me. That's okay. I don't care. My approach works and I do it. If you don't want to listen, this is why I have those other coaches that'll take you down a path that makes more sense to you. If you go with me, I take you down my path because I know how it works and this is what I have done. And not everybody is into that. Yeah, I know. I'm extreme carnivore, mostly because of my son Evan got hit with some sort of bowel syndrome, so Crohn's or IBS or whatever, and he used the Lion Diet to get out of that. So basically all meat. And I am sold on Jack's podcast on this, or his YouTube video diary that he did, and seeing my own son do it, and I went with him. So guys, it is possible to get a strict pull-up even in your 50s like me. But you have to put in the time. Again, I'll create something and send it over to Jack and you guys can click on it. If you need me, I am here to help. I literally don't want your money. I want you to be healthy and fit. I want you to live a long time. I want you to die at the hands of a jealous husband. So not really. Don't do that. I want you to experience life to the fullest. Part of that is prepping your own body. I've done it talk at Jack's fall workshops. You are zone zero. It's you. If you don't take care of you, then man, that's a big problem. Are you a hazard to the prepping around you? Are you a liability to the prepping around you? Or do you enable it? And if you can't get up off the ground without using your hands, or if you don't tie your shoes correctly because your belly's in the way, man, you're in trouble. But pull-ups aren't that far away. You just have to get started doing something. I know I don't throw this out there a lot, but I am here to help. I will probably guide you to one of my coaches because this is what they do on the daily. I am an entrepreneur and I run the gym, so I do group coaching mostly. I love that. I love being in front of people. I love being in front of the crowd and teaching them things and showing them how to do stuff one-on-one and in person in the classroom, not remotely, but I have coaches that do that. So guys, if you need me, give me a call, or don't call me. Give me a text or an email, andy@crossfitgarage.com. I am happy to help. Most likely, I'll see a bunch of you at the fall workshop. Y'all take care.
So the one exercise that I didn't see in his plan, and I don't think I heard him talk about it, here is a lateral pull down. And I've seen people go to really heavy weights with them and they lean back and they're pulling it to their chest, and that's going to work some of the same muscles. You guys probably know, you've seen the gym bro I'm talking about. His back is at about a 30% angle. He's got his legs locked into the machine and he's pulling down and touching like his chest down about where his heart is with these lateral pull downs. I'm not putting that guy down. There's nothing wrong with that as an exercise, but it changes exactly where the muscles are stressed. When you do a pull up, you're vertical. So if you take that lat pull-down bar and you grip it, instead of way out at the ends where you're changing the pull again, you grip it about where you would for a standard pull-up. You could set that weight to anywhere you want. And you put that on a place where you can do 10 reps to muscle failure. And then you do that. You make that part of your general workout. And then when you can constantly get to that 10 and you're not at muscle failure, increase it. And at some point, then you start actually adding more and more weight to where, like, you probably want a spotter so you don't get thrown out of the gym for smashing the plates, right? But you can maybe get 3 of those, and then you start, and then you run cycles where you're doing high rep, low rep, week to week like that. That will do a lot to improve the muscle structure, the skeletal structure, and everything you need for a pull-up. I don't really do pull-ups. I do chin-ups, and I do that now because of serious injury to my right shoulder. Some of you have actually felt the weird shit my right shoulder does, and it is just not a good thing for me to do anymore because of that. I will probably, as I age, have significant arthritis in that shoulder, or bursitis, or whatever the hell you want to call it. So I try not to aggravate that anymore, and I'll just say, I can tell you flat out, like, they are not equivalent. A chin-up just means instead of overhand grip, your underhand grip. The way that you can use your biceps and all, I can knock out some chin-ups. And I always could. Pull-ups I've always struggled with. That's why I know some of these things, too. The healthiest I ever was in my life, in the military, United States Army Airborne, et cetera, I still struggle with pull-ups. I wonder if I even would have gotten through Marine Corps boot camp with the requirement there. I'm not sure I would have. I think it's like 11 or something. I don't know that I've ever done 11 pull-ups back-to-back, ever. I guess if I tried hard enough, I would have. But the lat pull-downs were what got me much more able to do them, because you have the variability of weight, and you can push yourself to the edge, the absolute edge. I love the band suggestion too, though. What we used to do with that when we would train together when we were in the military is, you know, and the band is like standing in for a spotter, is we would, the person would basically cross your ankles and hold your feet up where your legs are at like about a 90. And then as you got to the point where you're at muscle failure, your buddy would reach down right below, but like put their hands under your ankles and kind of lift you, or under your knees from the front, and kind of push you and give you just enough to get that extra repetition done. I also love the negatives, the letting yourself down slowly. That is great for conditioning those same muscles, but it will only do so much because the muscles are working in a completely different capacity. So that's why I like the lat pull downs. Anyway, good question and great answer from Andy. Let's talk about AR slings with Mike Melito.
Hey TSP, Michael here of Gunfighter Life Podcast to answer your gun-related questions. Today I got one on slings for AR-15s. Now there's obviously a vast array of individual slings, but three big categories: single point, 2 point, and 3 point slings. In general, I'd say the Goldilocks is the 2 point sling. One is not enough, three is too many, but two is just right. For general purpose stuff, there are some exceptions, so let me tackle those exceptions first. Now, the 3 point sling. This one is a pretty complicated sling. It is made for older rifles that came about before all the modern sling attachments. For example, I joined the Marine Corps pre-9/11. I was there waiting in Kuwait for the invasion of Iraq. We had M16A2s with the old school, like World War II parade style slings. In order to make tactical slings, we would take two of those and some 550 cord and or some zip ties and literally make a tactical sling, because they didn't exist as a thing that we were aware of. We made our own. They didn't have modern sling attachment points. They had the old school parade style sling attachments. I remember when Black Hawk came out with their 3 point sling, which will let you attach a tactical muzzle down style sling to the existing parade style M16 sling attachments to go around the buttstock and go around the forend to orient that rifle correctly. That was a giant leap forward. If you still have an older rifle like that, I'm talking like a legacy M16 style, M16A1, M16A2, or the old school like CAR 15 with those old sling attachments, you may look at, if you don't want to alter the weapon, you may look at a 3 point sling. But if you don't have that, they're more complicated than they need to be. Now, the single point sling. These can be good for certain applications. If you just want the sling as a way to keep your adversary from gaining control of your weapon, if you just want the sling as a temporary thing so that you can use your hands for applying a tourniquet, for putting handcuffs on someone, something that you briefly just need to contain that weapon and keep control of it, the single point sling is okay. So for the average person, like a home defense gun, a single point is probably fine. If it's a gun that's going to live in a bag. When I was the commander of a tactical team in a large urban area, we generally carried our long guns in bags on us that didn't look like long guns in bags for obvious reasons if we were doing more covert stuff. Right, if I'm moving around with that rifle, it's in the bag. When I get close and I think I might need the rifle, I take it out, in which case a single point sling is fine. For those applications, a single point is simple, it's lightweight, it's fast and easy to take on and off. However, the reason I say they're not good for general purpose, not as good as a 2 point sling, they're not great for movement, right? If you're going to move long distance or you have to run, a single point sling is not great for that. It's not great for any kind of tactical movement. If you're moving a short distance and your rifle is going to be carried in your hands at a low ready or a high ready, again, the sling is mostly there as a safety mechanism, so the gun stays on you. If you're doing something real briefly, you can throw it around your back if you have to cuff somebody or something to deny them access. But as far as movement goes, any kind of long day, long shift, they're not great for that. So in those applications, gun's going to live in a bag. Maybe your truck gun's going to live in a bag. And if you had to carry it long distance, it would just stay in the bag. Or like a home defense gun where you're not going to be moving long distance with the gun. Single point slings are fine. But in general, for a general purpose AR-15, your M4gery, M4 clone type rifle, your general go-to fighting carbine, 2-point is really the best. You know, a modern 2-point, whether it's, you know, an M-lock attachment or even an older quad rail tactical cheese grater type attachment, the QD sling swivels, anything like that, a 2-point is a really good system. It's not overly complicated. Something like a mag pole is easily adjustable. You can have it pretty loose, throw it on fast, adjust it tight. Even if you have to go for a ruck or a hike, they're really good for that. They're simple. They're not heavy. They may be slightly heavier than a single point sling, but not by much. They also have the benefit of being able to be used with a hasty sling. If you know how to shoot like that, you know, your classic rifleman position, standing, sitting, kneeling, prone, you can use said sling pretty easily and get that, you know, good tension between your you know, rifle and your back of your tricep, if you know what I'm talking about. They can be made into a pretty quick loop sling. So for general purpose carbine, a two-point sling. So if you don't know or have another good reason or caveat why you'd go to a single-point or a three-point, in general, I'd say get a two-point sling. There's tons of good ones out there. I would say just look for one that attaches the proper way to your rifle, and then look for one that has a quick adjustment for the length of the sling, depending on if you're wearing body armor, not wearing body armor, throw it on fast, adjust it, hasty sling. So something you can quickly adjust. I hope this was helpful on the different kinds of sling styles for AR-15 rifles. Don't forget to send your questions to Jack, the Survival Podcast. And thanks for listening, and have a blessed day.
Great advice, but when he starts talking about carrying M16A2s, it just brings me back to, like, basic. And then my permanent party in Panama, I'm so old that in basic we used A1s, like Vietnam era. Half of them had the new rounded hand grips, and about half of them literally had the old, like you see in an Oliver Stone movie, like kind of the triangular grips still on them. When I first went to Panama, we actually still had A1s there, and just as we were turning in the Cutvies for the Humvees, we were turning in A1s for A2s, and I was dealing with an armorer bitching about how clean this freaking piece of shit was that we were going to turn in, and it's probably going to be given to, like, the Honduran Army or something, or some National Guard unit of a rifle I never touched until the day they told me I had to clean it to turn it in. But the flashback actually isn't anything to do with that. That's just being a soldier. Fixing something you didn't break, that's being a soldier. Is the road marches with those freaking old school slings that he was leading on about at the beginning. Old school 2-point slings, and having that thing slung over your shoulder and marching miles and miles and miles, and the pain that would develop behind the shoulder blade. Not everybody I served with commiserated with that pain. I would say about half the people seemed in some way susceptible to that sort. It was almost like a nerve pinch, and it really, really sucked. And the fact that I'll never have to do that again pleases me. I'll just say that. There's times I'm like, what would have happened if I stayed in the military? And I really don't know. But I know that I'm glad that I didn't, I guess is the way that I would say it. Anyway, let's talk about tax myths next. Tax myths, in case that got all tax myths, like sounded like that. Tax myths with Matt Sersley, who's going to do some myth busting for us.
Hey, everyone. Matthew Sersley here of AgrisTaxAdvice.com. One of the things I love most about learning more about tax law is finding all the opportunities to keep more money in my pocket. Now, of course, the thing I hate most about tax law is tax in general, but probably the second thing I hate most is all of the myths. I don't know where these myths started, but I grew up hearing many of them. Maybe somebody's uncle heard it from his accountant 20 years ago. Maybe somebody saw it on YouTube. Maybe somebody misunderstood the IRS rule and repeated it enough that they started believing it. Or maybe this was the rule 20, 30, 40 years ago, but things have changed. But I hear myths all the time. And the really frustrating part is not just that they're wrong, but they can be very expensive. I've seen people lose hundreds or thousands, in some cases maybe tens of thousands of dollars over the years because of these myths. So today I want to walk through four tax myths that I hear from business owners and see online all the time. Now, if you believe one of these, don't feel bad. Many people have. But once you understand the rules, you can stop leaving that money on the table. Myth number one. I need an LLC before I can deduct my business expenses. This is an incredibly expensive myth, and I've seen lots of people talk about it online, or people correct other people online, telling, no, you can't take expenses. You don't have an LLC yet. So if you're thinking, well, I don't have an LLC or a corporation, so I'm not tracking my expenses, wrong. The IRS does not care if you have an LLC. The IRS does not care if you have a corporation. The IRS cares if you are a legitimate business with the intent of making a profit. If so, you can deduct ordinary and necessary business expenses. These deductions don't magically appear because you paid your local Secretary of State a filing fee to create some entity. Now, maybe you should have an LLC. Maybe you should have a corporation. Maybe you should choose to be taxed as an S corporation. Those are all excellent questions to ask about liability protection and tax planning, but they're not prerequisites to taking deductions. The second myth that I hear is that I have to itemize on my tax return to deduct my business expenses. Not even close. Business deductions have nothing to do with whether you itemize or take the standard deduction on your personal taxes. They are two completely separate calculations. Your business figures out its income and subtracts its business expenses, and it has its net income. And then either it pays its taxes, or that total income number appears on your taxes for you to pay the tax on that. But on your personal portion of your return, Schedule A, you just figure out whether you take the standard deduction or whether you itemize for your personal itemization. They are totally separate. In fact, for the past several years, the overwhelming majority of my business clients take the standard deduction while deducting every legitimate business expense they had. So if anyone's ever told you, no, you can't deduct that because you take the standard deduction, they just don't know what they're talking about. Totally separate parts of the tax return, totally separate rules. Myth number three, my business isn't making money yet, so I can't deduct my expenses. I hear this from almost every new business owner out there. They say, well, I'm not going to really worry about tracking my expenses until I actually make money. Almost all businesses lose money the first year, even the first 2 or 3 years are open. That's normal. Maybe you're buying equipment. Maybe you're marketing. You're paying for a website. You're buying inventory. You're creating inventory. You're learning. You're figuring things out. And the tax code understands that. Now, if you don't have a business, if it's really a hobby, that's different. No, you can't deduct those expenses. But whether it's a hobby or a business, don't assume it's one or the other just because of somebody you saw online. If you're honestly trying to build a profitable business, track your expenses and take the deductions. Even in the very rare situations where your losses can't offset other income immediately, those losses will usually carry forward into future years. And so the absolute worst case scenario is usually you save the money a little bit later, but only if you report the expenses in the year they occurred. Now, if you don't have any revenue, if you haven't made a single dollar, then you might not be able to deduct expenses because the IRS, again, may not consider you a real business. You can probably get away with this for 1 year in the right business, maybe 2 or 3 years. But please, if you're going to take business deductions, have at least some business revenue. And now I'm going to take you to the myth that just refuses to die. Myth four, I'm not taking the home office deduction because I don't want an audit. This myth has probably cost business owners tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars over the decades. Years ago, the home office deduction developed this reputation. People thought, oh, if I take it, the IRS will come knocking. It's going to raise my audit risk. Well, even years ago, while that may have been somewhat true, the reputation was grossly exaggerated. In fact, almost all of it came from W-2 employees trying to deduct things they weren't entitled to deduct. There has not been any significant audit risk for a legitimate business person deducting the home office deduction in a decade or more. The rule is pretty straightforward. If you regularly and exclusively use part of your home for your business, you can take the deduction. Notice those words. Regularly, exclusively, part of your home. it doesn't have to be an entire room. It might be a corner of the basement, or a dedicated office, or a workshop in your garage, or a detached shed. Now, which of those it is may affect how it's calculated, but not whether you get it. All that really matters is that it's a legitimate business space used regularly and exclusively for your business. So don't voluntarily pay extra taxes because of an audit story your uncle told you 20 years ago. Here's the lesson I hope you take away. The tax code is complicated enough when you follow the actual tax code. It's even more complicated when you follow rules that don't really exist. Every week, I meet business owners who have been overpaying taxes, not because they made a mistake, but because somebody confidently told them something that simply wasn't true. Now, the really good news is almost all of these are really easy to fix. And many times, big tax savings don't come from some secret loophole or some fancy trick an accountant or a lawyer can do for you. They come from understanding how the tax code works and using the tax code's rules against the IRS. So anytime you catch yourself saying, "I heard you can't," stop. Figure out whether that's actually true, and don't trust YouTube and don't trust AI about whether it's true. But you might be surprised how much money that question can be worth. If you'd like to learn more about legitimate business expenses, or if you'd like to chat with me about whether I can help you, please head over to agoristtaxadvice.com and schedule a free call with me. Thank you.
So a few ads I have under this. Number one, I think the huge amount of myths around taxes, businesses, et cetera, not just the tax aspects of it, inheritance, et cetera. We can attribute how much bullshit there is today and why people like Matthew have to come out and say this is bullshit in the first place to what I call influencer cancer. We have all of these influencers trying to make a name for themselves, trying to build up their follower account, trying to generate an income by just, you know, being an influencer. And they just pick a lane. And if they find something that sticks, then they go with it. And then what happens is one of them says some bullshit. And then it's like a bunch of parrots. You know, you need an LLC. You need an LLC. Bark, bark. You need an LLC. It's like just over and over again. Right. Avoid probate. Avoid probate. Bark, bark. Avoid probate. I mean, that's just over and over. You need a trust. Bark. They don't know what the fuck they're talking about. And nobody that does this for a living, nobody that's a professional like Matthew on the tax planning legal side, nobody that sets up trusts, nobody that does any of this shit would ever tell you what you need to do without knowing the situation that you're in. How much money do you have? How many heirs do you have? What are your concerns? Where are you going? You have to have a conversation. It goes to the neighborhood of at least an hour to give anybody anything approaching a comprehensive plan to these things, tax planning, estate planning, etc. Minimum an hour to be even close. You might immediately suss out, hey, it really would, would benefit you. But you don't do these things one off. These are comprehensive plans. Okay? So the person that will start telling you what you need to do before understanding all the things you need to do, so how they go together, you cannot listen to. And most of these things come a person's doom scrolling, taking a deuce on the toilet, and next thing you know, some 28-year-old supposed billionaire who wouldn't be on freaking Instagram if they were, right, is telling you this bullshit, and then you don't necessarily believe that, but because of the parrot effect, you need a trust, but you need a trust, right? Because of that, you hit what's called the seven touch rule. I'm giving you some marketing stuff now. When you're exposed to an idea seven times, you retain the idea. The idea plays in the back of your head, even if you're not thinking about it. It's like the background processes in your computer or your smart device. And then eventually something hits, it triggers, and boom. And this is why marketers follow the seven touch rule. Like when I get you into a follow-up system, I ideally want to trust you at least, touch you at least seven times before you leave. Because even if you leave, when my brand comes back around again, there's an association with it. Okay? It's the same thing happening here. It's the neuroscience and the psychology behind the effect. The other thing, what he ended on of the audit stories, people say they were audited for reason X, Y, Z, and they don't actually know why they were audited. I have a family member who says, well, we don't use H&R Block because the one time we did, we got audited. Okay, these are people that have W-2 income, 100% W-2 income. Do they itemize and this is back before SALT and all, they do the mortgage deduction? Yeah, right. They have no business income whatsoever. Very little taxable investing income. And all in the married couple together at the time, I'm going to estimate, today it's much higher, but at the time I would estimate the income of about $80,000. You don't get audited with that income because you used a accounting firm, a specific accounting firm that took, unmitigated risk with your return. That's not what happened. There is literally what I call the sad lottery with auditing. And you can literally look up based on your income level and the type of income you have, what your odds of being audited are. And for someone like them, their odds would be 0.01%. But the IRS has literally automatically triggered audits at small percentiles based on risk assessment of the group, the cohort on income and type of income. And you won the lottery you didn't want to win. You didn't get audited because you claimed you had a freaking home office. I've been through audits, not as an individual, but as a business. It's not fun. It's like having a rectal exam by the lady from the Police Academy movie or something, right? It's bad. It sucks. But that's not why. And I have claimed a home office deduction for 18 years. I've never been audited for that. I've never been audited for a home office at all. It is one of those things, if you go extreme with how you calculate it, you can be. But my deduction is pretty damn big because I have a big house and we have two rooms dedicated to the business. My wife works in the business. I work in the business. We have two bedrooms. And because of the way they changed the SALT stuff and all, the deduction's much bigger than it used to be. But that's their code, not my manipulation. Because of the way they did things, what happened is things like your homeowner's insurance, things like part of your electric bill, et cetera, things like your financing expenses, et cetera. I don't even know all of them because I have a really great CPA. All of it in the new formula that they came up with backfeeds through the square footage allotment. And when I saw how big my deduction was, I was like, that's awesome. And my accountant said it's an unfunded tax cut. And I'm like, I don't give a shit. It's a tax cut. I'm going to put it down. I'm like, well, you do that, right? See that you do. Or as Captain Picard would say, make it so. But don't believe these bullshit things. That's why a lot of you guys over the years have known, somebody sends a question or asks one during a live feed, and Jack's going to say CPA and tax attorney, right? Because I'm not going to give you that advice because I don't have time to fully assess your situation. And even if I did, I'm not a professional on all the rules like Matthew is on the tax attorney side or like my CPA is on that side of things. That's why I employ people like that to do that work for me. Not just because I have some plausible deniability, because in the end, it doesn't really help you. But because I trust their instincts, their professionalism, and their training, because this is what they do every day. In other words, I would not hire a plumber, right, to work on my computer, and I would not hire a computer technician to work on my plumbing. I hire the right person for the right job, which that's going to fit really well into our next segment. And my segment today that I anchor the show with is going to be the real reason so many companies are not getting what they expect from AI. And this is probably going to be totally different than what you would expect unless you saw some of my posts this morning in various social media outlets or you've heard me talk about it somewhere else before. And it's not about the flaws with AI, because there are flaws. It's not a perfect thing, right? It's not about improper prompt use, right, or weak prompting. It is a totally different scenario. When we talk about companies, we're talking, remember I just said that in the Bitcoin segment, systems over personal discipline, always. Companies always run on systems. And there's a reality that once you grow to a certain size, you should do it from day one if you're a solopreneur. You should have systems that govern you in your own business, because it's really easy to fuck off for 4 hours and not realizing you were doing it, right? So you have to have systems in place. but it's absolutely mandatory once you have a certain amount of capital that you're pushing through a week on a payroll. You cannot afford for, you know, the people that you employ to not be, not just not like being lazy, but to be working on the wrong thing, even if they think they're doing the right thing. You can't do that. And you also have to have processes and procedures that you run so that, let's say, all customer refunds go through the same process, right? And there is an assessment and then an approval for refund or a declination of refund. And that might have something to do, like, if the purchase was made in the first 30 days and the customer asks for a refund and it's an electronic product, we just do it. If it is a physical product in the first 30 days, we just do it, but they have to return it, and we have to verify the return before we actually make the credit on their account, something like that, right? And you have to run it by that system. And there's systems for literally everything, and this is to create what's called a floor of performance. And this is where, as I grow a company into thousands of employees, that I know I need a junior analyst level one in this department. And if I hire the person that has this skill set and stick them in there like a part in a machine, they will be able to do the job. Now, if I'm doing my job right as a hiring manager, I still want to hire the person, not the skill set, but I'm hiring the skill set too. Okay? And because I have a system in place, I know that maybe they need a week to come up to speed, another week of some advanced training, and then unless I hired the wrong person, they can do the job. And even if they're not great at it, they will hit this minimum floor of performance. And if they can't do that, they're get fired, right? And that's how companies run. And no matter what anybody tells you otherwise, that's how every successful company is run. So those systems and procedures exist. Now I want you to try to do something here, to go into my world of always pulling up analogies. And I want you to think about that like a car. And that's why when your car is not working and you figure out that your alternator is no longer charging the battery, you go to the store and you say, hey, I need an alternator for a 2018 Toyota Tundra. And they say, you know, what kind of V6 or a four-cylinder? And you say four-cylinder. And they say something like, something stupid, right? Four-wheel drive or two-wheel drive, that doesn't matter. Put whatever the fuck you want in there. But eventually they like, here's a part, it costs this much money, and you go home and you unbolt it and you bolt it into the car and you start the car up and you throw your multimeter and you see it's charging the battery. Okay, you're good. And that's all you have to do, because that part goes in that place and that makes that system that is the truck run. I want to take you back to 1923. Yep, all the way back over 103 years. We're going to go back in time. This is the peak production level of the Ford Model T, which was introduced in 1908. So it took almost 20 years to hit peak production and begin to decline, and other things started to take over from there, right? And it went from a novel idea that nobody could afford, except for rich people as a novelty, to something that the everyday guy with a blue-collar job could buy, including the guy that was building it, ironically, yeah. And that was one of Ford's goals. If you work in my factory, you should be able to buy what we produce. If we can't do that, we're not optimized yet, right? So they had this little bitty motor in it. The wheels were made out of like wood with wooden spokes and rubber, real rubber tires from rubber trees on there. And they were pretty thin. And it had this little bitty motor, but it worked. And it was good. You get around with it. Like, people liked it. You had to stick shift and your everything like that. Now, I want you to imagine that somebody, because they figured out temporal conversion and just wanted to see what would happen, went back in time and took a couple containers, like shipping containers, full of modern V8 motors with them. And they took these with them back in time. And they showed up and said, Mr. Ford, look what we have brought for you. And they show him this motor. Now, Ford would have never done this because he was not a subtard, okay? But let's imagine a world where Henry Ford was also subtarded enough to try this. And they show him that this motor is more powerful, more fuel efficient in every measurable way. You were talking about a 354-bolt main. Like, and let's say it's not even today's cutting-edge shit, right? Doesn't need computers at all. It's a pre-72 when we fucked everything up with the smog shit. It's something that you would have put in a Mustang in 1969, a 302, right? Like, it's literally the same car family. It's just from 40 years in the future, okay? And I said, look at the horsepower, man. Look at the ignition. Everything. This is great. And they like, okay, roll that shit in the factory. And a bunch of these guys from 1923 try to shove this 302 that belongs in a Boss 302, 69 Boss 302 Mustang. They try to shove in a Model T. It doesn't fit. Let's imagine by some miracle they figure out how to bolt the bitch in there up to that little bitty transmission, into that little bitty differential that transfers the torque to those wooden rimmed rubber freaking tires on that car. Yeah? And you take it out on the road, you shove that thing in first gear and say, let's see what this can do. Woof! You're going to blow the freaking car to shit. It can't handle it. The option, the other way you could do it is if you don't upgrade the car, right? We don't change the drivetrain. We don't beef it up. We don't put better tires and rims on it. We leave it as is you have to neuter the motor. Maybe it goes a little faster than the Model T did with the original motor, but we cannot unleash the full power because the car can't handle it. What the hell does this have to do with companies and AI? Companies run on systems like a car. There's an approval process in companies to get things done. So we start an initiative, and then this person signs off it, and it goes back to the people that made the initiative. They build it out, comes back to the approval. Then that goes up another level of approval that somebody adds to it, and it goes through like an assembly line, just like the Model T did. Yeah? There is a, and the most mundane shit goes through a process like this. Maybe not as much back and forth, but signing off on payroll, right? Approving leave, right, or vacation time, right, has a process. Those are pretty mundane things. Everything has a process. How things are ordered. When a customer places an order into a company that actually builds custom orders, there's a process for that. When a customer places an order where the product is drop shipped from frickin' China, there is a process for that. There is a process for everything. There's a process for how an employee is trained. There is a process for how an employee is reviewed. There is a, what I'm telling you is there is a process for everything. There's a process for how a company vehicle is taken by an employee to do company business, how it is returned, how gas is put in it, who puts the gas in it. Do you put it in and file an expense report? There's a process for that. Do you just return it? And somebody, because you have a large enough vehicle fleet that you have your own fuel, there's a process for that. Who procures the fuel? There's a process for everything. Okay. So now let's go back to the Model T. All right. Essentially, you have taken, instead of cramming the motor into the Model T, you have taken a vehicle fleet of Model Ts and a company that built its entire operations and its estimations around how the Model T runs, and you then give all the employees AI. You've given everybody a freaking 800 horsepower freaking Shelby Mustang or Demon Red Eye freaking Challenger or something like that, right? Let's not be brand loyal here, okay? And then you've said, go! And the... And not only did you replace all the Model Ts and not change the infrastructure of the company, you're looking at the road system as it was in 1923, where more than half of the roads people drove on were dirt, and you're giving everybody a freaking Ferrari F90 or F80 or whatever the hell it is. Do you think it's going to work? Either you're going to destroy everything, or everybody has to drive around in granny gear because the infrastructure's not updated. There's your problem. That's why companies can't get what they expect out of AI. You haven't changed the infrastructure in the company. And I think about it another way. Like, think about it like an assembly line. And we make 1,000 widgets a day. Okay? And so we built the assembly line to make 1,000 widgets a day. And station 3... gets a new piece of equipment, and they can now do their entire day's work in 1 hour. Okay, no one can get any more, like Station 2 can't get the more stuff. And if somehow Station 2 does get the more stuff, they overload Station 4, who can't keep, like, then they just have a surplus of shit on the assembly line they can't get through. This is what's happening. You're speeding up pieces and parts of a company without adjusting its internal infrastructure, which is its systems, procedures, and processes. And they're going, I don't understand. We spent $9 million or $9 billion or whatever the hell dollars it was on this new software suite from OpenAI or Google or whoever, Claude, if you're stupid, Copilot from Microsoft, right? And it just really hasn't changed the total output of the company because you're driving a Ferrari on a dirt road in the mountains. Where if you don't tear the car apart, it can't do what a Ferrari does. So we have to retool the processes in a company, the way by which we train employees. The entire system has to change. Do you know why I can see this just abundantly clear? Very simple. Because I was working in these environments in 96, 97, 98, 99 when the internet took over. I watched people switch to using things as simple as like a Microsoft Excel from older. I watch people move from drafting to AutoCAD. And the same problems came up, but because the speed of change was slower and because earlier versions were slowly introduced, the transition, even though it was clunky, was much smoother. We were able to get the roads ready for the Corvette a lot faster or in time for the Corvette. It took longer for the Model T to turn into the Corvette than it's taken for basically the passenger, the Toyota Corolla. Like, think about it that way. Like, everybody today in the office is driving a Toyota Corolla, and now you're giving them a freaking Ferrari or a Lamborghini. Right? Like, it happened much faster. Think about how fast this happened. Nobody's using an LLM in an office. Just the same shit you have access to as an individual today. No one's using one in 2022 at all. It's not a thing. Not a thing. Fall 2023. Boom. Everybody has AI. Is it the best version? Is it the Ferrari version? No, but it's like the freaking souped up freaking Camaro version. 0 to 1,000 overnight. And then everybody embraced it or fought it, one or the other. The ones that embraced it were like, this is great. They were the guys in Henry's factory shoving the 302 Boss motor into a Model T without upgrading the suspension, the tires, the wheels, the differential, the transmission, the clutch. It broke. But instead of exploding catastrophically, it just didn't give results. So how do you fix it? You focus on the individual and the process that the individual follows. You have a faster car. You need to upgrade the track you put it on. And until you do, you can never unleash the full potential of the car. It is dramatically simple to diagnose and incredibly complex to fix. And that's what they're all scrambling to do right now. And many of them scrambling to do it. That's what they're doing, but they don't even realize yet that's what they're doing. So their strategic initiatives are off. And strategic initiatives are long term. A strategic initiative for a company in 2026 is like going to the moon in 1969. If you're off by a fraction of a percentile for something that you're sending from here to the other side of town, it doesn't matter. You'll be a little bit to the left side or right side of the lane when you get there, but you'll be where you're going. If you're off by a fraction of a percentile when you're sending a rocket to the moon, by the time you get to the moon, you're not even close. Strategic planning for a corporation is the same way. When you're off by a fraction of a percentile of your strategic plan, you are not planning for what you're going to end up at. And if your competition is, you're going to get your throat slit. Because there are companies that know that this is what they're working on. So if you're in a company right now that's adopting AI, and they're having these problems, and you are in a position where you actually have enough influence to influence the strategic plan around it, this makes you their rainmaker. If you understand this, and you can come at it with that mindset, and you can bring people on board with you. And if your company's not doing it, you might want to start looking for one that is. I'm just saying. Better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. That's what we talk about around here. This is another way of looking at that requirement. With that, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. We've wrapped up another week. If you have questions for me, I would like to go back to doing maybe one show a month that's just answering your questions instead of one segment a week that's answering somebody's question. And what I need is a variety of questions that fit the model where I can answer that question in 5 to 7 minutes. So send me your questions. I have a pretty good backlog right now. A couple more, and maybe Tuesday could be that show for you. But it might not be. Why not? I have something else planned for Tuesday, but maybe the next Tuesday can be. All right. I also have a pretty big announcement. I think we have just landed, as this show is being recorded, one hell of a new discount partner for MSB. I mean, when I tell you the name of the company, you're going to go, even if it's not for you, you're going to be, oh, I know them. Like that level. I don't want to say it is yet. I don't want to jinx it. But I basically solidified an agreement with the company CEO through LinkedIn while I was recording this in between segments and listening to the experts' responses so I could respond to them. So always working for you, always trying to make it better. I'll let you know. If it all goes through, you'll find out Tuesday who this new discount vendor is. Until then, take care. Have a great weekend. And if you have not picked up a copy of my book yet, Laws of Life Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life, please do. If you have, and it's given you any value at all, please consider jumping back on Amazon for just a couple minutes, just a minute even, and give me a review. Even if you give me a 4-star instead of a 5-star. Even if you say this book sucks, I don't care. I need reviews. We're starting to get some finally in. I was able to get them moved over on the first edition to the second edition of the first book, so that's nice. But I'm pretty light on reviews right now, even in spite of really good sales. And again, whatever you think, be honest. I'm not asking you to trump up positive reviews for me. Tell me what you really think. Tell the world what you really think. Give us a review. That is one of the most important things for an author on Amazon, to get reviews. I've poured it out for 18 years. If you bought the book, you must have enjoyed what I've been pouring out. So please consider giving me that review. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on Tuesday next week with, I think you're going to be shocked at the topic. It's going to be an interesting show. It's not going to be a clown show where we talk about news and politics. It's not going to be so much a how to do things on your homestead show, though it sort of will be. But it will be one of those ones that's just fun and a new way of looking at things. That's what I've always loved doing since the start of the show.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Revolution.